I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is the White House signaling that the cost of the war in Afghanistan, not just the exit strategy, is a top concern? The Obama administration released a photo last night showing that for the first time, Budget Director Peter Orszag sat in on Afghan war strategy sessions. And there's news today that President Obama will announce that strategy next Tuesday. Military officials expect the president to settle on sending 32 to 35,000 additional U.S. forces to Afghanistan, fewer than his commanding general wants, at a cost of about $1 million per troop per year. And some Democrats are asking, how do we pay for that? Michigan Senator Carl Levin has suggested an additional income tax on the wealthiest Americans, but Wisconsin Congressman David Obie and others have another idea. He's chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Congressman Obie, your thoughts.
Well, our problem is that for the past year we have been trying to pass health care reform, and it's going to cost around $900 billion, and we're told that we have to pay for every dime of it with offsetting cuts. At the same time, we're also being told that if we support General McChrystal's request for additional troops, that we should be prepared to hunker down in Afghanistan for up to a decade. And guess what? If we do that, the cost will be roughly the same as health care. The only difference is that we wouldn't be paying for the war. We would be paying for health care. I don't think that's right. The fact is that nobody in this country has sacrificed one whit except for military families when it comes to this war. And they've been asked to go to the well time and time and time again.
Well, let's lay out some numbers here. We understand that U.S. military spending in Afghanistan reached $3.6 billion a month this summer. That's more than $43 billion a year. And according to some estimates, in fact, President Obama uses a rough measuring stick that every 1,000 troops added will add another $1 billion to that annual $43 billion. You're saying Americans should pay for it. How do you suggest they do?
What we're suggesting is a war surtax so that it would begin as a 1% surtax for people, anybody with taxable income, rising to 2% if you are making roughly $150,000 a year. And then after you get up into the stratosphere in terms of income, it would be graduated to pay for the full cost of the war.
Is this the Share the Sacrifice Act?
It sure is. It's also preserved the National Economy Act, because if we don't do something like this, the cost of the Afghan war over the next 10 years could devour virtually every effort that we want to make to rebuild our own economy here at home.
So you start with taxable income between $30,000 and $150,000. How do you see taxpayers paying for the war?
You simply add 1% to the tax that you're already paying. If you are making $30,000 a year, you're going to be paying less than $50 in additional taxes. You don't add another percent tax on your whole income. It is simply a 1% increase in the amount of taxes that you otherwise would have paid.
Right. And then that rises as your income rises. Well, what about Michigan Democrat Carl Levin, who's with the Senate Armed Services Committee? He's also calling for a war tax, but just on the upper brackets, people earning more than $200,000 or $250,000. Why are you, stretching this across the pay scale?
Because I think this is an issue that everybody in society has to face. If we are going to fight a war and if we're being asked to do it for the next 10 years, I'm not comfortable with the idea that only military families pay the cost of this sucker. We get so many lectures about how we have to reduce spending on the domestic side and everything from children's health to education to science. And yet, when it comes to fighting a war, it's borrow up to the ceiling. That difference makes no sense.
Well, what do you say to the wealthier Americans in particular, those making $200,000, $250,000, who have already been told they're the ones who are going to pay for health care, and now you're also asking them to pay for the war?
In the last 6 years of the Bush administration, the wealthiest 10% of Americans took in 94% of all of the income growth in the country. they are doing quite well in comparison to average citizens.
Well, your proposal includes a waiver authority, so if the economy is deemed too weak, the president can postpone a surtax for a year. And it also includes a waiver for military families.
For families who have already had a loved one fighting in the war, I don't see why they should have to also pay financially. So we exempt from the tax anybody who has been involved in that war. I'm very dubious about efforts to expand our military involvement in Afghanistan, but if we are going to do that, and if we're going to be tied down there for the next 10 years, then at least we ought to pay for it. If it's worth fighting the war for it, then it's worth paying for it.
How do you expect this to go over in a time when, you know, you've got midterm elections coming up and taxes are the last thing a lot of lawmakers want? That's a word they don't want coming out of their lips.
I expect a lot of people to attack what we're doing and to try to misconstrue what we're doing, and I'm used to that.
Representative Obie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Again, Wisconsin Congressman David Obie, chair of the House Appropriations Committee, proposing a surtax, a war surtax, a tax on the taxes you already pay to pay for the war in Afghanistan. Well, did you know that in early America, wealthy men were allowed to pay poorer men to take their place on the battle lines? That gave rise to the slogan, rich man's war, poor man's fight. It doesn't sound fair today, as Representative Obie says, shouldn't we all bear the burden of war? But isn't that exactly what we do today? Through our taxpayer money, we pay other Americans to fight if we are not the ones fighting the war. And our next guest would take this further. He'd say, isn't paying someone to fight for you like paying someone to carry and give birth to your child? And while we're at it, if it's okay to have a paid army, why not a paid jury? Questions running into questions. That's what a class is like with Michael Sandel, professor of government at Harvard University. He teaches the wildly popular course Justice. It's now a 12-part series on PBS. Also the basis of his fascinating new book, Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? And we wanted to spend some time with him today asking questions that'll run into questions. Professor Sandel, welcome.
Great to be with you, Robin.
Let's just start by throwing out one that you do. You know, when is it right to torture a terrorist? Now, there are people who think it's not effective in getting information. There are other people who say even if it is effective, it's not morally correct. But let's address the group that says it is correct because it'll save lives. So you then make them answer us another question. Which one is that?
Right. Well, first, the moral intuition of people like former Vice President Cheney is if it saves lives, then you do it. There are no moral absolutes against torture. But here would be a test. Here would be a question, Robin, you could put next time you have former Vice President Cheney on your program. What would you do? Suppose the most effective way, the only way to get the information, would be not to torture the terrorist suspect, but to torture his 12-year-old daughter who knew nothing about where the bomb was planted. Would you do it?
Because that in seeing his daughter tortured, that would make him give up the information. That's the premise.
Horrible
thought, but that's the premise.
Effective. Yeah. Now, I suspect that even the defenders of torture, most of them, would hesitate there, which has an interesting moral, which is the idea of effectiveness, that numbers count, that it's simply a matter of adding up the lives saved against the pain to the victim, is not all that matters morally. Also is a moral intuition that justice has something to do with treating people in the right way, giving people what they deserve. I think even, maybe, former Vice President Cheney would shrink from that.
Well, let's give another example. Organ sales. You give the example of selling a kidney. We know there's a huge waiting list. People die waiting for kidneys.
Yes.
And so take us through the various reactions to this, you know, starting with some people who say it's okay to do it because there's so many people waiting. It's for the greater good.
Right. The argument for the greater good, saving lives, is a utilitarian argument. Seek the greatest good or the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. Another argument people are drawn to in favor of markets in organs, and one can imagine a global market, is freedom of choice. Consenting adults should be free to exchange whatever goods they want to.
Including
body parts.
Yeah.
It's my body, I own it.
Is that libertarian?
Well, that would be a libertarian idea, the idea that I should be free to do what I want to with my own body and whatever I own.
Right.
But you want a counterargument to that?
Well, don't we come to a human rights perspective?
Well, and which way do you think that would cut?
Well, having read your book, I know that Immanuel Kant, for instance, would say it's never right for a human to use their body as a means to an end. Even
right.
if the end is to save another life, it's not right.
Exactly, yes. Kant had this idea of respect for human dignity. And he thought that meant there were restrictions not only on using other people as means to our ends, as in the torture case, but that it restricted even certain ways of treating ourselves as being at odds with human dignity.
But even before you get to Kant, who again rejects this notion that the happiness of the majority rules, he feels that you can never, ever, ever use humans to some means for someone else.
Exactly.
But even before you get to him, you have another question that you would pose
right.
to those in the first two categories who feel it's my body, or
right.
it's their body, or it's for the good of the majority. And you ask them about the second kidney.
Right. Should a person be free to sell his or her second kidney, even if it means death, which raises questions. Now, some people, desperately poor, wanting to send, let's say, their second child to college in the developing world, suppose they say, I'm willing to give up my life to sell my second kidney. Is that morally defensible? And that's, it seems to me, a hard case, even for those who believe or think they believe that we stand as property owners toward our body.
Well, and what you do in this process is get people to question what they think is an absolute.
Right, yeah. right. To question really what we believe and why, to critically reflect on our own moral and political convictions and to try to sort them out.
If you think the utilitarian point of view is, well, you know, well, the majority rules, well, then you have to think back to, well, yeah, and the majority at one time wanted the Christians to be thrown to the lions. That didn't work out that well.
Yes, and it's true the Christian being devoured by the lion would suffer terribly, but if there were enough cheering Romans packing the Colosseum, it's not clear that the utilitarian calculus would not sanction that.
On the other hand, and we've got a minute to go before the break, but I can hear some listeners saying, I'm embracing Kant. I'm aware that Kant is some of the basis of a lot of human rights
yes.
work. But then you might come to the topic of assisted suicide. He was against that, and some people might be surprised by that. Why was he against assisted suicide?
He thought assisted suicide was actually another instance, like selling the second kidney, of using ourselves, using our own humanity, our own personhood, as a means for perhaps relieving our own suffering. And Kant didn't think we were free to use even ourselves as instruments or as means.
Oh, it gets you thinking. That's Michael Sandel, professor of government at Harvard University. His wildly popular course, I keep saying that because thousands pack the auditorium to hear you, is now a 12-part series on PPS. His new book is Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? Has he got you thinking about what you think about the right thing to do is? Just wait till we ask about Navy SEALs in Afghanistan and decisions they made. What would you do? We'll hear their story and others, give you something to think about when we come back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We've invited Harvard professor Michael Sandel in just to get us thinking, thought-provoking questions about morality and politics, what's the right thing to do. Michael, we were talking before about different questions and different schools of thought on things like torture, but you pose so many questions. Is it okay to lie to a murderer? Let's say someone's knocking on your door, a murderer, they're looking for someone in the house. Immanuel Kant would say it's not okay to lie to them. He's so strict in his thinking, but you could maybe say a truth that sends them away, like, oh, I saw that person earlier today,
right.
send them away. And then there's this really tough, awful, but thought-provoking story about Navy SEALs in Afghanistan. They come across two unarmed farmers and a young boy.
Right.
And they have to make a decision. What's the decision?
The decision is whether to let them go back to the village, in which case they could very well tell the Taliban, who are in the village, of their location, ruin their mission, But to prevent them doing that would require killing these goat herders and the boy in cold blood. They are unarmed civilians. They wrestled with this dilemma. This is a true story.
Right. Imagine being confronted with that. They let them go.
They let them go after much deliberation, and about an hour later, they were surrounded by 100 or 150 heavily armed Taliban. All but one of the Navy SEALs was killed. A rescue helicopter was shot down. All 11 killed. Yeah. And the Navy SEAL who cast the deciding vote was the lone survivor and regrets it deeply.
But does he really feel he would have been able to kill unarmed civilians?
Well, at the time, he didn't feel that that was the right thing to do. So here's a classic case of the tension between the utilitarian idea of trying to seek the greatest good for the greatest number, as he saw it, certainly sees it in retrospect, and a certain categorical moral prohibition against killing an unarmed civilian.
Yeah. You mentioned the utilitarian school of thought, greatest good for the greatest number, the libertarian thought, which is strictly for the individual. It's my body. I own it.
Right.
Less government. We talked about Immanuel Kant, who had a strict sort of, how would you sum up his thinking?
Immanuel Kant said there are certain things that are just categorically wrong to do, even if they will promote the greatest happiness for the greatest number. And lying or taking the life of an unarmed civilian, even for the greater good, may well be among them.
Well, the last category you talk about is egalitarianism. At the forefront of that, the Harvard scholar John Rawls, who died in 2002. What was his thinking?
He said the way to think about justice is to ask what principles of justice would we accept and agree to if we didn't know where we've wound up in life. We didn't know whether we would turned out to be rich or poor, born into a family that gave us a good education or one that couldn't, didn't know whether we would be healthy or ill.
It's a veil of ignorance.
Right, behind a veil of ignorance, not knowing where we would land, on top or on the bottom or somewhere in between. The principle we would agree to there would be, well, the two principles, respecting basic rights and civil and political liberties, and allowing only those inequalities of income and wealth that worked to the advantage of the least well-off.
In other words, the well-off need to share their spoils with the least well-off.
Yes.
Well, and you use different examples. I'm thinking price gouging. You talk about price gouging after Hurricane Charlie in 2004 in Florida. An elderly woman and her handicapped child are charged three times as much for a hotel room. There's a great debate that came after this, and you quote a columnist here in Boston who said that price gouging was good because it brings other...
increases the supply of the goods, of the hotel rooms, of the generators, of the flashlights.
People can get money for it, they'll come into the area and sell more goods.
Right.
And then you had then Attorney General Charlie Crist, now the Republican governor, dead set against it because he said, we have to think of the least among us.
Yes, it exploits those who are in desperate need. And so the utilitarian idea, and to some degree the free market libertarian idea, clashes with the idea that justice means not exploiting those who are in a desperate condition of need.
And you write that egalitarianism is the place where sometimes your Harvard students have the most difficulty. They go to Harvard, so in many cases, they believe in a system of meritocracy. I'm here, so I must have deserved it. And if you mess with the system of meritocracy, in other words, if you introduce thinking like affirmative action, questions about what people should be paid, reparations. These are the kinds of things that John Rawls and egalitarians would be concerned with. Then you're sort of interrupting their thinking about, well, wait a second, I'm here because I deserve it. And you ask them a question about their birth order that gets them thinking. What's that question?
Well, the question, John Rawls's idea is that justice should not be based on morally arbitrary contingencies, where, what kind of life we were born into. And so I test that with one idea, just asking students to raise their hand, those who are first in birth order, which supposedly is correlated with effort and striving, the work ethic. 75% to 80% of the hands go up, Robin.
Yeah. And they suddenly see, maybe I did have an advantage I didn't even know about, my birth order.
Well, yeah. It's a surprising, it's an intriguing thing.
Yeah. I just have to ask you one last thing. Gosh, the time flies. But we just want to mention that according to Harvard legend, the villainous nuclear plant owner Montgomery Burns in The Simpsons is modeled after you. How can that be? You're not murderous. You're not villainous. Although you look a little like him.
Oh, I hope not, Robin.
Well, apparently some of the writers of The Simpsons were your students.
I think so. It's an urban legend. I don't know if it's true or not. A number of The Simpson writers have taken the course. But he's a terribly unjust character, don't you think?
I do, but maybe there's the irony.
Maybe.
Although when you just looked at me, you really did look like him. That's Michael Sandel, professor of government at Harvard University, who teaches the course Justice. It's now a 12-part series on PBS, also the basis of his new book, Justice, What's the Right Thing to Do? What a great read. It started so many conversations in our office. Michael Sandel, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, tomorrow in Here and Now, the recession has cost millions of people their jobs. We'll speak with film director Jason Reitman. He hired some of those people to make his new film, Up in the Air. That's tomorrow. News is next, Here and Now. Preliminary findings from a decade-long study of the deep sea reveal a stunning abundance of life. Nearly 18,000 different ocean species live as deep as 3 miles under the surface, surviving in the cold and dark on decaying matter that floats down from above. Professor Robert Carney is an oceanographer at Louisiana State University. He's been involved in this study. Dr. Carney, the deep ocean at one time was considered an underwater desert. Now you and others have been seeing how many species there are. So what does this biodiversity tell you about it?
We normally assume diversity is associated with very complex environments, if you will, lots of nooks and crannies. And when you go into the deep sea, there are nooks and crannies, but just most of it, the vast, vast amounts of it, are either plain mud or just water. And yet we still have very, very high diversity, so we have to go back and start questioning our basic assumptions about what controls diversity on the planet.
And why it might be important to preserve it.
Yes, and you know, even though the idea that there was no life in the deep sea is clearly disproven, it's surprising the number of people I run into who I would think should know better. I have encountered engineers planning deep sea exploitation who don't know there's life in the deep sea, even fellow scientists.
Well, because people think it's cold, it's dark, it's high pressure, what could live? By the way, you were there. What's it feel like to be there?
The last time I was on the bottom of the ocean was just about 2 months ago here in the Gulf of Mexico, and the first time I was on the bottom of the ocean was just off New England there in 1976, and it is always a thrill. It is dark until you turn the lights on. It's not exactly monochrome, but it's getting there, and you're always operating in a floodlight, so the landscape beyond the floodlight is absolute black. And press your nose against the window or you lean forward in your seat as you move along the bottom, always looking at that edge of the floodlight, waiting to see something come in that you've never seen before. And also always wondering what is in the dark that is avoiding the light. You know, how many things remain unseen because they flee.
Well, I'm also looking at what some of them look like. I'm looking at this transparent sea cucumber. It looks like a floating bubble with a big ribbon on it, and then there's these sort of like little Dumbos with flap-like fins, you know, like ears. They almost look like nature's mistakes almost way down there. I mean, what's your sense of the creatures that you saw?
Well, I assure you their mothers love them.
I know. I don't feel bad saying it, but...
Yes. What you see with the transparent little jellyfish, it's actually a sea cucumber. And most sea cucumbers do honor to their name, and they look like a cucumber, and they sit on the ocean bottom and don't do a whole lot. And that particular animal has evolved to be very much like a jellyfish. It swims through the dark deep sea and then occasionally drops to the bottom and feeds on some sediment and then swims away.
And why is it important to know about them? I mean, we know that biodiversity is being impacted by climate change. We know that the changing temperature in the waters is endangering different species there. But why is it so important to know about all these thousands of creatures that you've been documenting?
Different animals, different plants, different bacteria do different things in the ocean. And if we don't start paying attention to who is there in what are they doing, then we're going to increasingly run into unexpected consequences when we start modifying the environment.
In other words, his mother may love him and he may be fun to look at, but that transparent sea cucumber may play some role we don't know that, just from a selfish point of view, may someday impact us.
Yes, that swimming little transparent sea cucumber is actually part of the carbon cycle. And at present, most of the models of what the deep sea does with carbon have reduced the world's largest environment and potentially the most biodiverse environment on the planet into a couple of equations. And I think taking it to the couple of equations for the entire deep sea is probably a mistake.
That's Professor Robert Carney, oceanographer at Louisiana State University there in Baton Rouge, co-director of the COMARGE Project, taking the census of the species in the deep sea. The full report will come out next year. And you can see photos at our website, hereandnow.org. Professor Carney, thank you so much.
It's always been delightful. Thank you for your time.
By the way, if you go to hereandnow.org, we'd always love to hear from you. You can click on Contact Us to send an email or leave a comment right there. And don't forget those cool pictures of the sea cucumbers. Up next, credit card cautionary tales, Here and Now. President Obama has signed legislation to reform consumer lending. Congress is considering a Consumer Finance Protection Agency. And a new Frontline special reminds us of the problems. In The Card Game, investigative reporter Lowell Bergman looks at how both the credit card and banking industries persuaded consumers to sign up for cards they couldn't afford with penalties they often didn't know about. Here's Don Bollinger, who was hit with cancer and a divorce and then a higher credit card rate, even though his credit card payments were on time.
Because of a delinquent payment on a totally unrelated debt that I had, one of the credit card companies told me that they were going to increase my rate from like 8.9% up to 19%.
Reporter Lowell Bergman joins us from the studios of UC Berkeley. Lowell, you begin the show with a rare interview with Shailesh Mehta. Who is he?
Shailesh Mehta was the CEO of Providian Financial, one of the sort of innovators, pioneers in the credit card business that started 20 years ago. He, along with his then-partner Andrew Carr, introduced a lot of innovations in the business, including bringing in tens of millions of people into the credit card marketplace who previously hadn't qualified.
And how did he do that?
Well, they did everything from cards that kept a balance so that people slowly were allowed to develop a credit rating, to taking care of the potential risks by, for example, charging interest on the date of purchase as opposed to having a grace period.
They also eliminated the annual fee. It made a credit card look free. But to be profitable, they then came up with what Meta tells you was a stealth pricing or penalty pricing system, a lot bigger penalty fees.
Penalty fees, but also penalty interest rates. We did a film, Frontline, called The Secret History of the Credit Card,
right,
5 years ago, much of it to describe how it is that in the United States there's no cap on interest rates.
Well, and you speak to one woman in the film who was late paying a $480 balance, I think, and through her fees, she ended up paying $3,000.
Right. She got to $480 on a $500 card that she accepted when she was in dire straits, and they got it up to $480. They thought they were safe, and then it turned out because they were late on a payment, they went over the limit, the $500 limit, and they got an over-the-limit fee. This just kept cascading before she finally stopped paying.
Well, Shailesh Mehta is pretty upfront about, you know, some of these practices. Here he is talking about, you know, how hard it is for customers to actually figure out what their credit card contracts say.
In a way, the pricing was designed that it would require a degree of some sort to understand how many different ways I'm paying and what I'm paying. You know, I mean, borrow on a credit card, nobody knows what the real cost is.
Nessa Fattis of the American Bankers Association, as do others representatives of the industry, say that, you know, the customer has a responsibility to check out the terms and know what they're dealing with. Of course, the problem with credit cards, which is no secret, is that if you tried to read one of those contracts, even if you had a degree in law, we've had many people say on camera and otherwise, they couldn't understand it. The other thing that's happening, however, that there are two major things that we deal with in the film is one is the shift to debit cards, and the other is the regulations and new laws that are coming into effect in an atmosphere where the economy, as you all know, is in trouble.
And you remind us that one reason the economy is in trouble is that people overextended on their credit cards and began refinancing their homes to pay off their credit cards?
Yeah, the research shows that a majority of the refinancing that was done, particularly in subprime lending in that period where everyone now says that things were out of control, was done to refinance credit card debt, which people did with the equity, the sort of mystery equity that was in their homes, the inflated home values. Now, with home values depressed, with foreclosures and so on, they can't do that anymore. And so the banking industry itself has a second big problem, which is that credit card defaults are skyrocketing.
Well, we also want to touch on debit cards, which were started some 20 years ago by a banking consultant named Bill Strunk.
Strunk and others came up with the idea of offering consumers free checking, no fee, wedded to it a, quote, privilege for overdraft protection, which meant if you went over, you bounced a check, or you used debit cards, which started to be used in the 1990s, you would get that withdrawal, that debit to your account covered, but you would incur a fee. And by the middle of the 1990s, they could charge any fee they wanted. And by the turn of the century, debit cards started to outstrip checks as a way of paying. And about 6 years ago, a little bit less actually, the Federal Reserve reaffirmed that the use of this short-term loan instrument to cover checks or debits was not really a loan under Truth in Lending, which is the act that you would think for loans would be the one operative. In fact, they were exempted. And you saw 80% of the banks in the United States starting to do this overdraft protection and not denying withdrawals or sales at the point of sale.
It might be hard for some younger listeners to believe, but back in the day, you'd get contacted. You'd be told you're overdrawn and we're not going to let you do it anymore. But now, as you said, you can go on and in one day incur incredible fees. Let's listen to Josette Wormuth, who had that happen when she went to buy a pizza.
Bought a small pizza for $7 and ended up getting charged a $33 fee. So it ended up being a $40 pizza.
She kept throughout the day doing this,
right,
and she wound up with like $350 in fees.
Right. Well, we've had Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren on this program many times. She's the person behind this Consumer Financial Protection Agency. What's your sense of how much of these problems are going to be addressed ultimately by that agency?
Well, assuming the agency is created, it's now before the Senate Banking Committee, and they're having active debate. They're expected to vote on it sometime after Thanksgiving. It should be able to, for example, regulate fees, although it's a pretty loose language in the bill right now. It just talks about reasonableness of fees. The bottom line is nobody seems to be willing to tackle with the fundamental question, which is interest rates and whether or not those should be regulated. People forget that at one time it was very difficult to charge anywhere over 18% interest for a loan anywhere.
And now, just give me a sense of what an interest rate a credit card might go to.
We've seen rates as high as 45-50% when it involves someone, particularly who's a foreign national working in the United States and may not have a credit history. There are punitive rates that have been reported even higher than that. But many people have seen their rates go up to 29.99, 30% or so in the last number of months as the industry both deals with a shrinking economy and pending legislation that will come into effect in February.
Ouch. That's investigative reporter Lowell Bergman. His Frontline report, The Card Game, airs on PBS stations tonight. Everything you ever wanted to know about how we came to where we are with credit cards. For more, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Lowell Bergman, thank you so much.
Thank you, and watch out when you're shopping.
Thanksgiving is just days away, and the burning question is, wait, no, we don't use that phrase. The question is, what to serve with that great big turkey, or instead of the turkey if you're a vegetarian? Let's bring side dishes front and center with Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, who's brought a few right here into the studio. Kathy, the smell.
It's pretty good, huh?
It's pretty darn good.
And there's no turkey in sight.
No, it just
goes to show you.
Yes,
the
actually.
The side dishes are the star. Everyone denies it year after year, but the truth is, these are sort of the signature dishes. If everyone's roasting a turkey, That's what it is, right? But it's these wonderful potatoes and vegetables and stuffings and cranberry sauces that really define your background, your ethnicity in many cases, all the different spices that go into it. They're totally the right. thrilling part of Thanksgiving.
Right. My stuffing is sweet. It's going to have the apple juice and the raisins and the walnuts in it. And, you know, as okay. opposed to somebody else's, it's going to be savory.
Yeah, well, I live in Maine, and we use fresh oysters with lots of leftover bread and fresh celery and thyme. But no one, my kids for years never knew there were oysters in there. They always are like, yum, what is this? I'm like, uh-huh.
So just a viva la difference right there. And you have really plumbed this. You and Jonathan King and Jim Stott of Stonewall Kitchen in Maine have put together a whole book of celebratory dishes, the Stonewall Kitchen Winter Celebrations, and brought some with you. But just to start, you know, as... For instance, you're going to put a fruit in with a vegetable over here that many people may be resistant to, just to, for people who are afraid to change.
Well, it's a huge topic. It's really a psychological topic,
oh, yeah.
the idea of ritual and tradition. Thanksgiving, maybe more than any other holiday, is all about rituals. It's not about buying gifts. It's simply about the kitchen and the foods you put on the table and who you share it with. I'm a huge believer in tradition and creating rituals, but I'm also a huge believer in breaking them. This is the first year that one of my daughters won't be at the table, mm-hmm. and I feel really conscious about making this different just so that I don't pretend that everything's the same.
Are you all right?
I'm going to make it. Yeah. It's sad, but it's so exciting. Like, she's out in the world
right,
and growing
right.
up. But this year, for instance, I mean, and it's small stuff. So butternut squash we have every year. This year, I'm going to add the juice and the zest of blood oranges, which are so spectacular. Maroon colored juice, super intense orange flavor. You've got it right in front
yeah.
of you. So you have the bright orange from the butternut squash. All you do is steam it and then mash it with fresh juice and a lot of orange zest.
Oh my.
No cream. No, you can add butter if you want, but it doesn't even need it.
There's no butter in this?
No, this is light
oh,
and
wow.
fresh. And it tastes like the best of winter. Like, don't you just feel awake?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is...
She's perking up, people.
Orange-scented butternut squash. No butter. That's,
yeah.
That's great.
It's pretty phenomenal.
Okay. And by the way, as always, we'll have Kathy's recipes and a video for you at our website, herenow.org. But take us to the next dish.
The next dish is not quite as light. And this is an important part of side dishes, is that you want to balance color, texture. On the plate in front of Robin is this gorgeous orange butternut squash. Next to it is a fresh fennel and potato gratin. Potato gratin is a fairly traditional dish for the holidays. But I thought, what could we add? So you have a potato gratin with a little bit of heavy cream and some milk and butter and fresh thyme and rosemary. But I thought that slightly anise flavor of the fennel and the crunch would really lighten up a kind of heavy traditional potato dish.
I just bit into several pieces of the fennel, which kind of look like slices of onion, only they're
right.
thicker. Yeah.
It's a bulb. It's a pale green bulb with a lot of green fronds on top that look like dill. They were baked with the potatoes for about an hour in the oven, layered potato, fennel, fresh herbs, a little bit of cream on top, pop them in the oven, dust some Parmesan cheese on them. Yum.
Mm,
just fabulous. And then the third element on the plate
I'm
here.
Just going to keep eating.
Please do. I can talk forever.
Sure, yeah. Go ahead.
This is very fresh and light. These are fresh steamed green beans. Just trim them. Steam them for about 4 or 5 minutes, drain them in cold running water, stop the cooking. Do that a day ahead of time if you want.
Ah, so we were talking about this prior to the program. You are a plunge into cold water gal because that keeps them green?
Well, there's an actual term called refreshing vegetables. And what it means is that you pre-cook them and you absolutely stop the cooking. If you didn't plunge them into cold water, they would continue to cook and you'd have these limp green beans. So
yeah.
It's not really a belief system. It's necessary. Then what I do right before dinner is I heat up a skillet. So I'm freeing up the oven from all the space that the side
right.
dishes and the turkey take. Heating up a little bit of butter. You could add olive oil if you want to lighten it, let it get nice and brown, and then I'm adding chestnuts. You can now find these vacuum-packed chestnuts that are, all the work's been done for you. They're absolutely wonderful, and I slice them up, and I heat them in the butter, and then I throw my steamed green beans in, and I grated some Meyer lemon zest on top, completely crunchy and green, and it just balances out all the richness of the turkey and the potatoes and the stuffing, and isn't that nice?
The chestnuts are very soft.
buttery, huh?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really like this. And again, not a lot of fat, not a lot of dairy, but good, fresh crunch.
Let's just do a quick, lightning round with you, as long as we have you.
I'm ready. Hit me.
Brine the turkey or don't brine the turkey?
No, unless it's old and sad looking. And if it is, why are you using it? It's very trendy right now to brine meat. And what that means is that you place the turkey or a pork roast into a vat of salted or seasoned water. It's an extra step for most cooks who are already completely overwhelmed. I say no.
Okay. Stuffing inside or out? We do this every year.
Both.
Right.
I always stuff inside the turkey because what happens is that stuffing is getting basted with the turkey juices. So that is going to be just the moistest, most fabulous stuff. I always make a lot of stuffing. I put half of it in the bird, half of it in a casserole. But then when I'm basting the turkey in the middle of the day, I take a spoonful of the juices from the bottom of the turkey pan and I put it onto the casserole where the stuffing is in the oven separately so that it gets the benefit of those wonderful turkey juices.
If someone doesn't want apples in their stuffing, you can do it separately.
Exactly. You could do two separate ones.
But what about concerns about bacteria if something isn't cooked?
There's no problem with it as long as you don't stuff the turkey ahead of time. Never, ever put stuffing into a turkey hours ahead of time. You want to stuff it, close it up, pop it in the oven.
Well, and Kathy, as we said, you've put together a book on winter celebrations, and there's a section on instant holiday appetizers from the pantry. For me, that would be tuna on a Ritz cracker. But what would one be for you?
Well, the whole idea of having a well-stocked pantry beside the Ritz crackers and the tuna fish robin is that people do tend to stop by. And we're not talking about super fancy things here. For instance, if you had a can of white beans, you could drain them, rinse them, throw them into a food processor with a clove of garlic, some olive oil. If you had pine nuts or almonds, and you'd have this instant white bean dip. Mm. Really delicious, incredibly inexpensive, incredibly good for you, and the kind of thing really you could put together in 5 minutes. What else? A deviled egg is always like just a retro food that's so in again. If you had a few eggs, to just boil them up and mash the yolks with chopped olives or scallions or fresh herbs and put them back in. You could also mash some blue cheese with a little bit of sour cream and serve them with a flatbread or inside celery. These are the kind of things my grandmother used to serve that I'm telling you, there's a real warm spot in my heart for these quick, instant, retro appetizers.
That's Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, with a few new takes on side dishes and some old favorites as well, slicing up celery, of course. She's the co-author, along with Jonathan King and Jim Stott, of Stonewall Kitchen Winter Celebrations. And there's also Stonewall Kitchen Breakfast, if you're still hungry the day after. Kathy, thanks as always, and happy Thanksgiving.
And to you, Robin. Enjoy all those side dishes.